Welcome. You're listening to Sample Space, a show where we try to explore tools, thoughts, and techniques from the world of machine learning that deserve some more attention. My name is Vincent, and I will be your host. In this episode, I'll be talking to Trevor Mance, the creator of AnyWidget. It's a tool that allows you to make components that make Jupyter a kind of more interactive than it already is. You can use it to create charts that you can interact with, but the interaction goes both ways. You can interact with a chart, and the chart can actually interact with Python on your behalf as well. And I was just very curious what drives someone to build such a tool. It also feels like an interesting moment in time because the tool is gaining a lot of traction as we speak. I had a lot of fun talking to Trevor, and I hope you'll enjoy this conversation. All right, so there we are. Hi, Trevor.
Hi.
Hi. So I think this conversation needs a little bit of an introduction. The story here is that I wanted to make something that would help me teach, and I made this thing called Draw Data that allows me to draw something in a notebook that I could then use like to demo something in machine learning. What it allows you to basically do is you get a canvas, you can click a button, you can start drawing with your mouse, you can make a bigger brush, smaller brush, you can have different colors, and then you have a data set that you can use for classification, which is pretty cute. The cool thing here, though, and I thought that was particularly interesting, is that there's an interaction between like JavaScript stuff, because we are doing things in a browser, but there's definitely as a user, you're just still interacting with Python. So you can draw something, and then there's this widget variable that you've made, and you can just call like to pandas, to polars, and you can get your data out that way. Now, I actually needed a little bit of help to build this. So I went to the AnyWidget Discord, and that's how we met, which I thought was like an interesting way to meet. And from there, like more interesting things happened because the draw data thing turned out to be relatively popular. It's been doing good demos for a bunch of projects. And, you know, since we are starting a podcast here, I also figured this would be like a fun first conversation. Like, we can talk a little bit about the perspective from your end, like, hey, you've been maintaining this AnyWidget thing, and then I came along and we learned some stuff. But I'm also just genuinely curious because it does feel that this project has some mileage to it and actually can go to a bunch of places. So, to the dear listeners at home, that's what we're going to be talking about. But maybe like a good first step here is, Trevor, I made a thing in AnyWidget. To the people at home, like, what does AnyWidget do and what superpower does it give me?
Yeah, so thanks for the intro. The AnyWidget brings Jupyter notebooks to life. And so it really extends this idea of like literate programming where you write some code, you execute that code, and normally you might just observe some static outputs in the notebook cells, but with Jupyter widgets or with any widget, you can really bring those notebook output cells to life and give them web superpowers. So you can embed some JavaScript, CSS, and HTML, and now you have some interactive element that a user can interact with. And importantly, it reuses pieces of the Jupyter framework so that you can actually interact with variables that live in the Python kernel. And so this really opens up this ability to extend Jupyter notebooks with this like extra interactivity dimension. And any widget makes that easy.
Yeah. I remember back in the day when I was trying to do this draw data thing, like without any widget, it was pretty easy to get something to work as in, okay, inside a JavaScript, you can copy something to the clipboard. And from the clipboard, you can then get it into pandas because pandas has this read clipboard method. But the real interesting thing here is that you can draw something and potentially you can select something afterwards and then send it back to Python. So it's definitely not so much a from Python, I send it to the front end and I get a chart. It's much more a, and then that chart is interactive and can send stuff back to Python.
Yes. I think the fancy word for this is bidirectional communication. So often you can have this sort of unidirectional piece where you do something in Python and now you have a JavaScript output where you can interact with things there, but that state is sort of like trapped in that JavaScript world. And the thing that any widget lets you do is you can actually bring that back into the Python world as well. And so these two sort of disparate places, the browser and the Jupyter kernel, can talk to one another.
Well, not just only that, but it's also, they can talk to each other, but also from Jupyter. And that's something that I think is pretty interesting too. Because Jupyter, you know, you can have arguments about maybe it's not the best dev environment, right? Like people have strong opinions on that. But in terms of an environment to explore, I do think it's like been very like proven and very powerful. And at the same time, like it has felt that some of this interactivity has been missing, because it's always been, well, you write code in the cell and then the cell can execute and you can move on to a next cell. But it's very rare that you're rendering a cell and then you're interacting with it for a while before actually moving on. Like that's also kind of like the interesting experience of using these widgets. When there's a bidirectional communication happening, there's actually more communication happening as well. So one thing I kind of wonder is, my understanding is that you are a PhD student right now, and your domain is in the biomedical data space. That's kind of where you're working in. And, you know, I can definitely imagine sort of complex data structures happening there, and there's need for like interactivity between more the bio people and like the programmer folk. So I can kind of see part of the path that would lead you to build something like this. But it's always good to also take a step back and wonder, like, how did you get started here? Because, I mean, there are Python people who also do JavaScript, but it's an interesting mix that I seem to see here. So how did you end up sort of working on this project? Like, what's the path that you took here?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, my background is in data visualization, and I work in a lab where in the HiDive lab, where we build visualizations for biomedical researchers. And a lot of the data structures or the data that we get are sort of come from new experiments that sort of necessitate the need to design like new visualization tools to help people effectively explore those data. And so we're sort of already in the world where we're building very customized visualizations. That's sort of my domain. I'm working in creating visualizations for biomedical researchers, but then my interest in open source came from early on looking at open source visualization projects. And in particular, I got very interested in this visualization library called Vega Lite, which is a declarative grammar, sort of like ggplot from R, but for it's sort of cross-platform visualization grammar of graphics that is a JSON specification that runs in the web browser. And my contributions for open source started by creating examples for the Vega Lite documentation. And then there was this Python library that popped up called Altair, which allows you to create these Vega Lite visualizations using a nice Python interface. And I just really love this idea of like writing these little Python scripts that generated these interactive web visualizations. And so, you know, I got into the Altair Python library, and very similarly, like very nice community there, and started contributing to their documentation as well. And this was like a very early phase of me getting to open source. And I was just really drawn to the community aspect and feeling like I had some impact, or, you know, I'd make these little examples and then I could see them in the documentation. It was a very welcoming way to get started.
Because one thing I wonder there is, because I'm aware of Altair and also like the Vega story behind it. It's originally it's definitely more of a front-end library where like you can declare that you want to have a scatter chart, and then there's a JSON specification, like a config that's really specific, declarative, known up front, that allows you to say, oh, but I want to have circles or squares or different colors of dots, let's say. And because it's all nice in the front end, you get this SVG that you could zoom in and out on. And because it's a spec, there are libraries that people have built on top of it. So that's a really cool ecosystem, but it's very much a JavaScript entry point. But then was Altair kind of your first dipping your toes into Python? Is that the order of things?
Yeah, exactly. I think that like one thing that I've found is that with a lot of visualization stuff is that a lot of the interesting interactive visualization things are happening in the web browser, but a lot of like where you actually work with the data are not happening in like in JavaScript, for example. And so there's a lot of like pre-processing to the data that you need to do before you can actually like use some of these visualization tools, or they build in some ways of transforming your data to be able to then, you know, use a nice declarative grammar, but usually there's a little bit of like massaging of the data. And so I got into Python because, and specifically found Altair because I could do all of this data pre-processing and then just dump the data into the visualization in a notebook. And I just love that feedback loop of being able to have this single like notebook document where I could do my little bit of pre-processing and then get out these interactive visualizations that then I could put into like something like HTML and share with someone separately.
There is something interesting there, yeah. Because Python is indeed the place where you do the data wrangling these days. You can just pip install wrangling tool, and you can go ahead and wrangle, get the data in the right shape. But a lot of the like visual stuff, sharing stuff, communication, a lot of that really is browsers still. Like Python is making its entryway there, but we're still not at the point where you can use Python to actually program like a proper JavaScript engine on the front end or anything like that. So it's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way, but it is pretty interesting to observe that the communication part of data science, a lot of that is still browser stuff. Interesting.
And especially for these notebook environments, like the actual environment that you are editing the notebook cells and executing them are in the browser. So it really is also the front end to being able to write your code is also now like a browser, often a browser-based environment. So,
And yeah, not true. That's definitely interesting. I mean, and there are various degrees in this. Like there are people who write Python libraries in Jupyter. I recall Jeremy Howard giving a few talks on that. I'm not sure if I 100% subscribe to that. I still like my IDE. But the exploration stuff, like it does feel like that's now moved to like some sort of front end. Most of the time it's Jupyter. Sometimes it's like Google Colab or VS Code. But a lot of that is browser stuff under the hood. I think VS Code is wasn't that Electron for a while? Like it's still a browser, I think.
Yeah. So for folks that are listening that don't know this, Electron is like a framework for building cross-platform like desktop applications. But the front end or the piece that you interact with is like an embedded Chrome browser. So it's web technology based.
The trick is we're still building a website. It's kind of what's been happening there. But okay, cool. Like, but then your background is definitely like a little bit more from the front end originally, and then you start like contributing to this Vega thing, and you know, there's a little community around it. But then you see Altair, and like something about like was there something about Altair in particular that drew you in? Was it because the project was like fairly early, or was it because you were interested in a mix of Python and JavaScript together? Like, was there something specific about Altair that made you kind of like curious?
Yeah. So I think the thing that I liked about Altair was what is something that you mentioned before, like the way that people like pip install packages for like processing their data or like sort of doing their data wrangling. Altair was the first instance of a project I came across that like you could just pip install and then you got to do some of the cool interactive visualization stuff that I was familiar with from the front end side. And so it was really like, it drew me in because it felt very seamless to use this visualization library inside of an environment where folks like actually process their and work with their data and where I was working with my data. And so I wanted to, you know, understand like how that worked. And also, you know, if I am building visualization app, tools, like can I make some my tools feel very similar to that?
Yeah. Oh, okay. And I can also imagine in the end, you are someone who's pursuing a PhD in this field. So the fact that then the interactive visualization library in Python drew you in is also not the biggest surprise, I suppose. But then, very cool. Like, okay, you see Altair, you kind of go, this is neat. You start toying with it. And then comes a moment where you think, well, I might be able to contribute. Like, I think that's part of the story as well then, right?
Yeah, so it all started with, documentation for Altair. I found that they had this, like, directory of just examples. And I thought, for whatever reason, like, I saw people contributing there. And I thought, you know, I'm familiar with Vega Lite. Like, there's some, like, the concepts map between the two. And so I started taking some of these Vega Lite examples and moving them into Python. But that was really at that time, like kind of all of the extent of my contributions were these documentation around the project.
And how, when was this? Like how many years ago?
This was probably like 2019. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Like a while, but not like ages ago, like 4 years ago or so.
Yeah. 2018 or 2019. And then, but one thing that I came across in Altair, and this sort of like foreshadows, I guess later how I got sort of involved in the project again, was that the way that it embedded this like front end component of the Vega Lite ecosystem, for lack of a better term, it's like it was very like surface level. So you define like your visualization specification, and then you render your sort of interactive visualization, but you know, often the first thing you want to do in these interactive plots is like make a selection or something in the plot. And there's a longstanding issue in Altair where folks who were using the library were asking like, is there a way that I can just get that back out as a data frame? And at the time when I was first contributing that project, the answer was basically like, no, There are things that are called Jupyter widgets, but they're pretty hard to make. Like that's sort of out of scope right now for the project. And I remember how I came across like Jupyter widgets in the first place. Yeah.
And I think I might have been one of the people who upvoted that issue. I remember. Yeah, yeah. So because some of the stuff that I've been doing was like, there's a library that I maintain called Human Learn, and one of the things that library allows you to do is it allows you to sort of draw a machine learning model instead. So if you have a 2D plot in front of you, you're able to say, well, if it's in this region, it's blue. If it's in that region, it's green. And you can export that to a scikit-learn compatible model. I remember vividly, the Altair is just such a nice chart to look at. Like, it's nice and minimal. I would love for that to work in Altair. But Altair didn't have the ability to then move that back into Python, so I ended up using Bokeh for it. But I do vividly remember upvoting that issue. And I believe it was like a very popular issue. Like, I wasn't the only one upvoting that thing.
Yeah, I think especially when you have an output like that, where there is some interactivity, like the thing you want to like click on a point or something and then get that back on the Python side, or there's some sort of maybe almost a user expectation that that would just work. And then, yeah, everyone finds this issue or that just, you know, it's not something that's currently possible with the time.
So for a while you've been contributing to like the gallery, which is especially for a visualization library, by the way, the gallery is super important because that inspires people to like consider what you can build. But at some point you also start reading some of the issues and you kind of go like, all right, there's something general about Altair that seems very hard to do. That sort of is a limitation, not so much of what you can do with Altair, but it's more the communication beyond what is possible with Altair right now. Like, that was sort of your observation. You looked at the thing and you kind of went, well, all the stuff within Altair is great, but there's this extra thing, this extra integration with Python, and that's more on a Jupyter level. Like, that's kind of, I can see the path towards that conclusion. Is this a fair assessment?
Yeah, and I'll say, like, from the time I was contributing those documentation to, like, I also then started the PhD and was like starting to build some of these visualizations of my own. And like, I had seen in that issue, there was mention of these things called Jupyter widgets. And like, I had started to try to build some of these of my own because like, I was running against some of the problems that are this same type of limitation with some of the visualization tools that I was making at the time. So, and then I was, that led me to recognize that I think that there's more of like a fundamental challenge with like building these types of like deep integrations with Jupyter, which then sort of led to this AnyWidget project that you came across, and now we've connected because of the Discord from. So
but it was definitely like Altair made you, well, the initial spark actually came from contributing to Altair. Like, that's the origin story here, I suppose. And was this like by the time you already started with your PhD, or was this before that?
I think this was like right at the beginning of my PhD, because I was doing some work in Python, and but then when I started getting into my research, that was sort of when I took a step back from those direct open source contributions and was sort of like working on my own projects.
Yeah, okay, and you're doing a PhD, so you also have like the time to go deep into something. And the interesting thing here is, in some ways, you're a bit of an outsider, because most of the time, people who are doing Python stuff, they might have a background in mechanical engineering or like a sciencey field, so to say. They do a bunch of NumPy. But I think in your case, you knew Altair before you actually dove deep into something like NumPy. is this accurate? Like the
Definitely. Or I was familiar with data frames before I really knew what NumPy was, because it's very like tabular. Now like Pandas is built on top of NumPy, or I actually don't know the relationship there, but yeah, I was used to Pandas concepts before I was used to like multi-dimensional arrays.
Yeah, no, but so this is what I also think is kind of interesting here, right? Like, sometimes good ideas happen when someone comes in with a different perspective. Like, that's something I've noticed a bunch in sort of open source land. Like, sometimes you need a different idea in order to sort of the thinking that got you into a problem is usually not the thinking that gets you out of it. And I think this is kind of a nice example, because to get this thing working where inside of a Jupyter notebook, you have a very interactive thing that can give you Python stuff back, you need to have a more thorough understanding of what the browser can do. Like, without that knowledge, it'll be a lot harder to build this thing. So that I think it's very interesting that you start from JavaScript, you then go to Python via Altair, and then you kind of go back to sort of putting your front end hat on, so to say. But then from there, okay, you start the project. So then you work on a demo first. Like, was that your approach?
So I'd say like it, taking a couple steps back, like it started off that I had these visualization tools that I'd made with web technologies. And then when I was looking for a tool to how I could integrate those like effectively in Jupyter, there was this thing called Jupyter widgets. And so Jupyter widgets allow you to connect like the front end interactive elements that are in the browser with objects that live in the kernel. And but the tooling that I found around like creating these projects, the tooling there, I've been familiar with sort of the front end ecosystem where like there's a really nice developer experience for one of just like being able to quickly like edit files and you quickly like the browser updates immediately and you get to like have this very quick feedback loop for iteration. And just the state of affairs with the tooling around creating these Jupyter widgets was like really, really cumbersome in comparison. And so I found that like, even though these were maybe some of the more like, even the widgets sort of opened this door to me being able to bring my visualization tools to like users in a really effective way, I like never wanted to work on these projects because like the experience was just so challenging from the developer perspective.
Yeah. So, there's an interesting difference there. So in Python land, in my mind, and I might be like slightly biased here, but in my mind, you can pip install your way and it will work most of the time. But then if you want to do something in the front end, it's very much a save a file, refresh the page, kind of a manual workflow. Whereas if you're doing stuff in NPM, I mean, that's like the node version, like the node installer and all of that. Stuff moves very quickly, so it can feel brittle at times. You got to keep your packages up to date. But then once you get the thing actually working, you don't even have to, like, you save the file and the entire website's automatic, like updates automatically. And there's something about that workflow from the front end that's, I guess, less common in Python. Like, we have the notebook, which is kind of like our like reactive playground in a way. But I can definitely imagine you looked at the story we have in Jupyter where the best you can do is like quickly add a slider and then get like a chart to update. That was kind of the state of affairs a couple of years ago. But then I guess like the first inkling for going for your own library was also just frustration. Like you wanted to build a thing and you just noticed that it was not as easy to even work in front end land via Python in the notebook than you hoped.
Yeah. So for context, the way that really the challenge for building these Jupyter integrations is that Jupyter is so popular that it now a lot of different tools support writing and executing these like IPy notebook files. And so the kernel side of that, or like the backend piece in Jupyter, is the Python bit is very uniform. And so it's pretty easy for all these different environments to support like that backend piece. But the front end side of it is a very like rough surface area, for lack of a better term. And that's because at the time when Jupyter was first created, this JavaScript toolkit or JavaScript like didn't have a formal like module system. And so that...
And this is like the JavaScript JavaScript technology in the browser. There are like the browser can do more stuff with JavaScript these days than when Jupyter got created. That's the observation.
Yeah, like JavaScript was invented in like a couple weeks as like a scripting language to like add a little bit of interactivity to HTML pages. And nobody thought that like people would be building these like huge applications in JavaScript or huge libraries in JavaScript to do like interesting things in the front end. And so it's sort of like this, like for a long time, the way that you'd like load JavaScript would be to just like add globals to the page. And so when you want multiple libraries to be able to like work together, that's a real challenge. So this idea of like packaging these widgets, if we both share the same dependency, like we could override each other. There's just issues with having this like global piece. And so after Jupyter was created, there was a formalization of something called like ECMAScript modules or JavaScript modules, which are like the official way to sort of like package and reuse code. And it solves like a lot of these challenges. And so from the front end, being familiar with what was happening in the front end, I'd seen like this fragmented ecosystem of front end tooling sort of get drastically simplified in like the last couple of years, just because like everything's turning into the, like just targeting these ECMAScript modules.
Yeah. And so that's kind of like, sort of to maybe translate that into something in Python land, imagine doing a Python project, but your computer can only have one virtual env. it kind of feels like that in a way, right? So then before you would have to like really manually keep in check that, I'm using version 1 of pandas here, version 2 of pandas there, and I can only use one virtual env. So there's all sorts of hoops you got to jump into. That was the situation in JavaScript when Jupyter got created. And right now, this this ESM stuff, this like ECMAScript modules, I think is the formal name, right?
Yep.
That makes this a whole bunch easier. So there's way less dependency concerns, and things just move independently of each other. And you can imagine as a developer that can really simplify stuff if you make use of it.
Yeah, so I'd say like the real challenge was that because there was no formal module system, and everyone who makes like these different environments that run in the web browser to run Jupyter recognized that that's a problem, they all either picked or invented their own solutions for managing modules. Right. And so what that leads to is that it's like, as a widget developer, you have to understand how Colab loads something compared to how Jupyter Lab loads something compared to how Jupyter Notebooks or VS Code. And so it just ends up being this like very high barrier to like actually contributing like or playing around with some of these integrations, and then making sure that it's like consistent across those environments is like a huge maintenance burden. So
yeah, so that's actually I vividly remember thinking like, oh, this draw data thing, let's do it properly. But then every time I started looking into the JavaScript, and if I only get it to work in Jupyter, I'll get people from Colab to complain. And I really don't feel like spending weekends and like maintaining JavaScript stuff that I don't understand super well myself, right? So that's actually like a huge feature of any widget. Like just the fact that I have to worry less about how, like, it'll just, if you get it to work in Jupyter, it's 99% likely that it'll just also work in VS Code. There might be edge cases, right? We don't, like, might always happen, but that feeling is super valuable.
Yeah. So the, like, that's a hope that I've had with the library is that you as the person who's building on top of any widget should have a lot more confidence that like the features you're adding should like work in all these different environments. And perhaps a more of a motivation around why I ended up working on any widget in the first place was that I'd like make these couple widget projects, and then Colab would change something, and I need to like update all the different packages to like upgrade to like these manual build steps to make sure that it was supported now in both Colab. And
there's something interesting about that too, from the perspective of a maintainer, because you didn't start any, you already had some visualization projects before you started any widget. And that actually gave you a bit of an edge in a way, because I can definitely imagine that that exposes you to the pain points of maintaining widgets, right? And so you've already felt the burn, and that probably was enough for you to sort of think, okay, to solve this, because how many widgets were you maintaining back then? Like three already?
I think there were like three that I was kind of, had like maintained or had contributed to. And through that, I sort of understood these like really, I don't know, undocumented corners of like how all these different front ends worked. And so there'd sort of be these random fixes, like add this to this JSON file and now it magically works in Colab. That sort of got me into like, okay, these are the path forward for compatibility. And then I was familiar with this like new ESM thing. And that was really inspiration, was like, maybe I can simplify my life a lot if there was a way that I could like solve this compatibility issue once and then just write ESM across all my other projects.
And that's the moment where words, and then worlds collide is basically what kind of happened in a way. But okay, now, so I just want to stand still there for just a moment, because I can, like, one thing I've noticed for some of my open source projects is, as a maintainer, at some point you are still maintaining a project, but you're not necessarily a user. And it's always kind of a tricky place to be. Because at some point it's possible that you kind of get out of sync with the experience of your end user. But in this particular case, because you were exposed to something of a niche problem, you were also very well equipped to sort of have an opinion on how to fix it. Part of what I always try to do here is also like, what's the real story behind how such a package got made and also by whom? In this case, it really makes sense that someone like you actually got around to it, basically because the time was right, if I hear you correctly, but also you had exposure to this problem.
Yeah, and I think I also had exposure to maybe how it could feel to like make widgets. Like I had a sense of like the if we solve this problem, like what a vision for what that could be, because I had a reference point from like the front end ecosystem. So that inspired me to think like, can we introduce these like really nice, like update a file and update and like reload that automatically? Can we do that in Jupyter, like without having to sort of like start up this NPM ecosystem and all that kind of stuff?
That's also a nice build. Like the first thing you probably attacked then was the your own developer experience.
Yes, like it. Usually, I'm developing tools for other people, and I have to talk to them a lot to understand their problems. And then in this perspective, it was this thing where instantly I could like I was the audience I was making that tool for.
Yeah,
and I'm familiar with like what this could feel like. So then I wanted to try to bring that to my own workflow, but. Also, I knew if someone had worked with widgets before and they tried this out, like it would kind of be like night and day in terms of like that developer experience, and really be a nice entry point into like some front end stuff for people who had never touched any of this before.
Yeah, so, I could definitely see that because the better, like you're going to invest a lot of time and effort in your own developer experience, and in doing so, you're technically also doing that for the first timer. And that's like I guess the right order of things as well. The moment that you start working on a project and then you start, and only after a month or five, you're going to worry about the developer experience. And by that time, it might be too late to actually go in and focus on that.
Yeah. And I think like the status quo for like what trying to make a Jupyter widget for the first time was before any widget was that like you maybe had, like often you had sort of this Python developer or someone who wanted to dig into like, oh, I've heard about widgets. Like I want to make this. And then like you start reading the documentation, the first thing it starts off is saying like, well, you need Node.js, you need like all these different packages to be able to like bundle up all these things together. And like, I can imagine that experience alone led to this impression that like the front end ecosystem is just totally fragmented. I don't want to touch that at all. And I think that like the more modern take on some of the front end stuff is actually quite minimal. And like, I don't know, as someone who started off in the web ecosystem, I thought like maybe there's a way that I can bring some of that, like the enjoyment that I have now in making these visualization tools and making that like initial impression of the language much less friction, or introducing like less friction there and more like the right tool for the job rather than trying to find like some Python library that lets you like kind of write JavaScript code behind the scenes. Like, maybe we just make JavaScript a little bit more approachable. And then if you need to, you can like poke around in the front end.
And well, to some extent, that's what any widget does, right? I mean, you can pip install it. And then the only thing you need is a notebook, write a little bit of extra JavaScript, but you can do the whole widget from a notebook if you really wanted to. Like that is, I think, kind of like a nice feature because you can go to the any widget website. There's a demo that you can just copy and paste. It's something with a button and like you click it and the counter happens and you can clearly see what part is the JavaScript side, what part is on the Python side. But that's kind of interesting because it also means that the environment in which you're going to, the deployment environment for the widget is a notebook. And if you wanted to, the developer environment is also the notebook. And something about that is also kind of nice and powerful because you just copy and paste the code once and already you get the full picture. Like, was that something that happened by coincidence or was that by design as well?
Yeah, so it's interesting because like the solution to like all the challenges that came with widgets was really like ECMAScript modules, like this ESM concept. And then there's all these pieces that fell out of that decision for any widget that like allowed us to introduce like this like better developer experience. But really it's just like an artifact of that. The way that we load and execute the JavaScript code on your behalf in the browser to let us like make those design decisions.
So a large part of the story was just browsers are more modern now. There's less like we can do this in a more fun way these days, and it's just a solid attempt at modernizing in a way. Like that's also kind of a thing that happened here.
Yeah, I for the initial release, we didn't have this like real time development experience built into any widget, so there was like. In order to like opt into that, you'd actually have to start like a NPM project and like run this separate like web server. And then I had this realization that like Jupyter itself or Jupyter Notebooks is a web server. And so maybe there's a way that we can like what you were just mentioning with the developer environment, like so you can use widgets in notebooks, but you can also develop them in notebooks. There was this realization where like maybe I can try to retrofit a Jupyter server to actually also support development of these things. And that way, you totally bypass the need for having any of the like the front end tooling. You can just have this really nice developer experience from within Jupyter and Jupyter Lab.
So there's one feature I think that would be good to just briefly touch on with these widgets because the Jupyter widgets, they've been around for a while. And there is this one feature that came, I think, from the original widget ecosystem that is kind of cool. Like what you can do inside of a notebook is you can declare a widget. And then if that ever changes, let's say someone moves a slider or someone clicks a button, then another widget can react to it. So it's not just the fact that we've got something in the front end where we can select stuff and move it into Python. It's also the fact that these components can kind of talk to each other. So for the draw data thing, I have a little demo where you draw something, and the moment that you're done drawing, a machine learning model automatically trains. Was this something that was complex to design? Like, were there any hoops from the JavaScript side yet? Like, I can imagine that you also want to mimic the way that these Jupyter widgets interact with each other properly. Was that like an easy exercise, or did that require like diving into like some sort of widget protocol as well? Just curious.
Yeah. So this is actually really a testament to the original like design of Jupyter widgets, in that like the messaging protocol that they use allows for, or it sort of forces you in the front end to write in sort of this reactive type of programming where you like listen for changes and apply updates. In a way that it lets you on the Python side configure how all these things talk to one another. And then the way that you've written your front end code is just to sort of update according to those configurations. So,
So from the JavaScript side, I'm kind of used to like, okay, you might have a callback. So there's like an event in JavaScript, like someone pressed a button or like a response come back from the server, and then we're going to react on it. But that's all JavaScript stuff. And I was actually pleasantly surprised to see that you can actually write a callback like thing from Python. And then kind of the magic is that on the front end, JavaScript can say, I need to update. And then that is then handed off to Python, after which it hands it automatically back to JavaScript if need be. Part of me was wondering, was that like by your design, or was that like something that was somewhat visionary from the widget ecosystem from way before?
That was certainly visionary from the widget ecosystem from way before. I think like the choice in like tech, like libraries that are available in the front end for doing that, they made a decision there, but like the actual protocol and the way that you, if you make a change that emits on the Python side, that also emits on the JavaScript side, that's all done through this like model coordination framework and using something called the Jupyter comms. So it's like this messaging channel where you can send messages back and forth. And there's just semantics around when you update a value or you, set one of those callbacks that will actually emit a change to the front end as well, and vice versa.
Right. So it's
deeply baked into widgets. It's just that, there's so much around, like that concept is deeply baked into widgets. I just think that it's pretty hidden in the documentation because you have all this extra stuff about like how do you even set up a project for a widget. Like there's a lot of tooling pieces and not sort of, I like to call them like essential widget concepts, and that there's actually a part of the AnyWidget documentation that's called like Jupyter widgets, the good parts, and it's just trying to distill down like what are these like minimal building blocks, or what is this front end Python communication look like, and like what are some common patterns for like connecting these two worlds.
One thing that the interesting thing here is like I represent someone who's just written an AnyWidget thing, and I'm talking to the person who wrote AnyWidget, so we can kind of share a perspective. So one thing, like because you just mentioned the whole comms stuff, I was blissfully unaware of that. Just like in scikit-learn, I'm not aware of all the numerical optimizations that are happening under the hood because I don't need to be. I will say most of the time I was really just dealing with a Python object and a Python function and maybe a callback or something like that. Was anything needed on your end to sort of support that, or was just something you figured, well, I can just hide that, no need for the end user to sort of deal with that? Was it by design as well, or is there still like a way to touch those things if you want to?
Yes, so that's a great question. So I think like what I hope with AnyWidget is like the goal is that it should feel approachable from both the Python side and the JavaScript side. So if on the Python side, dealing with these objects should feel just like Python, maybe with something like callbacks, which might be unfamiliar if you haven't written sort of like evented programming, but it's still just Python. And you can totally touch, like use widgets as an end user and never play around with like the front end. You can connect them together completely from within Python and sort of create rich user interfaces that connect these sort of like reusable visualization components together. But if you want, you can also sort of lift the covers and go further into the front end, and you have all of the web platform to poke around with and extend and use all the web APIs that are available there and package that up in a way that other end users can just use that from Python. So there's sort of this like incremental complexity, like you can totally interact with widgets in a very like surface level Python side, which I assume is probably the majority of the way that people will actually use Jupyter widgets. But then if you're a developer, it really opens the door to for you to be able to use anything that you want and the front end piece.
So one thing about that, I mean, I do a little bit of JavaScript, and it's interesting to see like how the web ecosystem has been growing and growing. Like the other day I learned there's a GamePad API. Like, did not know that, but browsers come with GamePad support these days. And I have like pretty, I have fancy keyboards, and apparently there's a thing called Web USB. Like I can flash the firmware of my USB devices via a browser these days. So it's kind of becoming like a like an operating system at the same time, but also like as a just a massive amount of APIs that are available. From your perspective, are there like browser APIs that you're specifically enthusiastic about? Something that makes you kind of go like, "Ah, man, the future." Part of that's going to be just this thing that you can do in the browser.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of different APIs that are interesting, but the one from being in a visualization group, like the one that's most interesting to me probably is WebGPU, which is a new GPU API that was introduced in the web browser, introduced by Chrome a couple years ago, and now has been standardized across all, or is becoming standardized across all web browsers. And this really allows for bringing high-performance rendering, which was already possible in the browser through an API called WebGL, but also bringing GPU compute to the web browser as well. And I think that this, as a visualization researcher, like it brings, it solves a lot of the challenges that WebGL had for us, but then also opens this door to not only being a graphics rendering API, but also like a compute API.
And is that then, like in my mind, well, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I can imagine sometimes when you make, let's say, a selection in your widget, like, I don't know, there's a 3D MRI scan or something, and you want to make a selection, would this imply that before you would have to make a selection, then move that back to Python, do your compute thing, and then move it back? But now with the web GPU, we might keep that in the front end and only move it back to Python when we need to? Like, is that the dream forward, or is it like a subtle difference?
Yeah, I think it just opens the door for a lot of like new levers that we can play around with for interactive experiences in the browser. So if it makes sense for that compute to be able to use that shared GPU memory and like do that very quickly, then yeah, I think that could totally be like a web GPU program. But if it's something that, you know, we want to expose as like a callback to some Python user, then we can send that data back in some way for someone on the Python side. And so I think it really opens up this door to interesting like design patterns, but yeah, and it's just Web GPU is also just an API that brings a lot of new GPU features to web browsers that like WebGL hasn't had, for example.
So I wonder if there's also maybe like a little Rust story here, because people are using Rust more and more to speed up Python programs. But my impression is that a very similar thing is happening on the front end at the moment. So I can imagine that there are maybe PhD students who come up with a, I will call, fancy algorithm to do something in the front end via Rust, maybe something that's not necessarily available to every GPU out there. But the moment that the browser supports it, like that does open up the playing field a little bit. Like, is that also something, like I can imagine that's on the roadmap as well, but I don't know if that's like your field particularly.
Yeah, I think the exciting thing for me is that as like there are more like high performance extensions that are being written in Rust, both for Python and for JavaScript. Like people sort of hide some low level algorithms behind like a Python API, but behind the scenes, it's probably just like it could be like a Rust extension, for example. And I think that one exciting thing to me is that because you have this sort of compiled language that now you can run in the browser, because there's this thing called WebAssembly that you can compile Rust code to and call that from JavaScript, that allows you to write sort of reusable algorithms that you can decide whether that runs, like you want that to run maybe in the Python kernel, but you could also package that up in a way to run on the web client. And that's just like an extra piece of flexibility to designing these like interactive applications that I'm excited about.
You're right. So so you write the Rust code once, and then it's up to you to run that via Python or via the web thing, because it's just a UI API thing at the end. If the core in Rust has been written and you can compile it to the right platform, Rust won't care if the request came from JavaScript or from Python in that sense.
Yeah, so it's funny you mention that, because there is this newer AnyWidget that's called Mosaic that really illustrates this concept of like packaging this like low level code and distributing that maybe in the front end or in the back end. And it behind the scenes, it's using for that component, it's using this library called DuckDB, which is a database system for like high performance database queries. That is sort of like a single binary and is able to run in process. And so this makes it so that it can both run in the web browser, but also run sort of in the backend.
Oh, so that Mosaic, is that using like a compiled DuckDB that's also running in the front end, or is it, it can do both, or is it also running in the backend?
Exactly. So it really is illustrates this, like, does it make sense? So in the case where, so Mosaic is really this, connection of interactive visualizations with backed by a high performance database. And I mean, there are many details set architecture, but I think that's the nice way of describing it. But what's nice is that in the case where you don't have like maybe a server, you can actually compile the database component to run in the web browser. So you can have a standalone HTML file that is running database queries that's totally running on the web page. But in any widget, they move that database into the Python kernel. So what happens is, rather than having this really heavy front-end application, you actually have a very lightweight front-end component. And then the SQL queries are being sent back to the back-end and being executed with the native compiled version of DuckDB. And so it's this really nice illustration of like it, this world that opens up where you can, you know, depending on like where you're deploying this visualization, you can actually like decide what type of back-end you want for it, whether that runs in the browser or these lines are really getting blurred, like what a backend is.
So Mosaic is indeed one of the, I think, more popular widgets these days. And I'm saying that because as we're talking, I'm looking at the gallery, which you recently put up on the AnyWidget website. If you go to the AnyWidget website, you can click this community button, and then you see a bunch of widgets. You'll notice that Draw Data is high on the list. But that's a couple of interesting projects here. Mosaic is definitely one of them. But one thing that I couldn't help but notice is that on top of this list of community projects is a library called Altair. And if I recall correctly, wasn't Altair like the thing that got you into AnyWidget originally? And that is like,
yeah.
Am I right to observe that is Altair now a user of AnyWidget?
Yes, you are correct. So Jupyter invited me to write a blog post about AnyWidget to sort of share this technology. And in that blog post, I wrote like a short tutorial that shows how I would solve that like sort of long-standing issue with within Altair, where you couldn't actually select like data and get it out of the Altair visualization. And I showed like in a few different cells, like creating an AnyWidget from scratch that at very surface level exposed that ability. And that sparked a conversation with the Altair folks, and we actually implemented a more like robust implementation of that original widget within the Altair library. And now there's an Altair Jupyter widget that you can use as a new rendering backend for these Altair plots. And so it has sort of this happy circle where like I started off creating this documentation, but now any widget has found its way back as a formal part of like Altair's project.
This is almost a fairy tale like level of story this is, because but then every time that I'm using Altair inside of a Jupyter notebook, under the hood it is using the AnyWidget to sort of support and run it.
I believe at the moment it's not by default powered by a widget. Like it's something, Altair has this idea of these like renderers, and you can like enable different ones,
right? So you can, and the base behavior is still that you're going to get like the default HTML chart, and I believe you can also get to like a PNG image. Like there's ways to do that stuff too, I guess. But then there's a setting that allows you to use any widget to do interactive stuff with these components.
Yeah, and actually the really big piece that comes out of this is there was this limitation in Altair where on top of this, where you actually had to send or the way that it generates these like static, these outputs is that it embeds your data in the specification. And so you, there was this rule that people would run into where if they tried to plot like more than 5,000 points, where it sort of gives this warning.
It would raise a warning, like the well-known warning. Like you're trying to draw more than 5,000 points, think twice. That was a warning you used to get, yeah.
And so there, I don't know if it's currently implemented, but now there's discussion where like rather than starting this like Altair data server piece, which sort of helps you get around that problem, the solution might be to actually use the Jupyter comms or the Jupyter framework to send that data in binary to the front end. And so what that affords is this ability to actually like a very seamless way for end users to not run into that 5,000 limit and to have like a more interactive and scalable component.
So that's pretty interesting too, because my impression was that usually the way that you would communicate between the front end and back end is you would do that with JSON. Like you would serialize something in Python. Like let's say you've got a pandas array, you would turn it into a list of dictionaries and that would kind of get sent to the front end. But what you're alluding to here is that we can actually send binary data over and back. So then what's the main use case for that? Like I can imagine things, but I'm curious like what people are doing with that now.
Yeah, I think I'm looking at the community page or the gallery. I think a lot of the top sort of few widgets on here are making use of this ability to send binary data. And the main use case that I've observed is there's sort of two different types of data that I've been seeing sent. One are NumPy arrays. So it's very easy to get the underlying bytes for a NumPy array. And rather than serializing those to like a JSON list, you can actually just send that binary data. And the second is there's been this unification around tabular data using a format called Apache Arrow. And so a lot of these systems are actually making use of Apache Arrow in the front end. Where you send this Arrow IPC or sort of this like
Arrow standard thing.
Arrow standard over this the connection and being able to sort of zero copy that onto something like the GPU it's not zero copy, it's like a single copy, but you don't have to do any serialization. So you skip all this like serialization between JSON because you can just send the Arrow standard over the wire.
Right. So to compare that, like in the old days, what you should do is you have a pandas data frame in memory that needs to be turned into a list of dictionaries. Then that list of dictionaries needs to be turned into a string because that's something we can send over the wire. Then JavaScript receives that string, needs to turn that into a JavaScript object, and then you do stuff with it. So you've got like, in the old days, you would say those are six steps you got to go through. And then what we're talking about now is it's just like, you've got the connection open, send the one object in the right binary format, and the other end is good to go. Like that's, I would imagine, like a pretty significant, like not just performance increase in terms of CPU, but also memory, right? Like that would save a whole lot of the memory space, I would imagine.
Yeah, exactly. So you're not allocating these like individual, I mean, we don't need to dig into it, but you're not creating individual JavaScript objects. You just have this chunk of memory that someone knows how to interpret correctly because it adheres to like the Arrow standard, or it's just a C contiguous array of bytes from NumPy that you can give to as your in WebGL world or shader world, you create these like uniforms or pieces of memory that you upload somewhere. And usually you can just take that data and put it right on the GPU and you don't have to do any extra serialization.
Right. And then you also get back into the field of like, okay, there's a Rust library for it. It just needs to have the data in some binary format and then it can go vroom basically. That's now sort of something we can play with as well.
Yeah. So I think a really nice illustration of this on the community or gallery that we now have on AnyWidget, there's this project called Lawnboard, which is a interactive geospatial vector data visualization library that's all oriented around bringing Apache Arrow representations of geospatial data and rendering those on the front end with a geospatial visualization tool called DeckGL. And that low-level component you were just talking about, so there's all this low-level Rust adapters to sort of discover on the Python side, discover and like extract the data from various geospatial data frames or objects on the Python side, getting that data out as Arrow and then rendering that with the same visualization library on the front end. And so it really is a nice example, like what you were saying before about like the way that you normally serialize things. Like this works, totally works if you have a couple hundred points or thousands of points even. But when you get into the realm of like millions of points, you want to be using binary data. And Lawnboard's a nice example because I think the existing integrations of this front-end framework called DeckGL and Jupyter we're using this like serialization approach. And I was looking at a demo, I think, with like 3 million points, where it took, in one example, it crashed the integration. In the other example, it took minutes to load 3 million points in the front end. And with this Longboard approach, it takes maybe 2 or 3 seconds to load 3 million points and render them interactively.
Yeah.
And so, it just really, like, you not having to do the serialization layer just is so powerful.
So we're not quite at the sort of blink your eye and it's there just yet, but like we went from minutes to seconds. So that's like a definite like order of magnitude speed bump.
Yes.
And you can also kind of see how you need that for some of the interactive stuff as well, right? Like the interaction works because it's interactive. It needs to be sort of quick and snappy. So it's definitely cool to see some of that stuff as well. I'm looking at the gallery and there's like a bunch of things. There's like a library to have like the million points, like the Jupyter scatter thing. I think that's well known for being able to handle many points. I also see widgets for astrology data. I can imagine that those are pretty data intensive as well. So there's definitely like a lot of fun stuff to look at. And if you go to the community page, by the way, you see very pretty GIFs that immediately give you an impression of what the project is all about. Given all these examples, though, like I can also imagine, like from the perspective of like the maintainer, there's like things that you have seen pop up that might have been a pleasant surprise. To me, what I've learned with the draw data thing is, for some reason, it was a nice tangible example that people wanted to play with. So I noticed that a whole bunch of people were also eager to build like support for it. I think Panel wanted to have a demo and they added like a little bit of extra support. Solera, Marimo, there's like a bunch of these places. And I guess from your end, that's also kind of interesting because it partially makes it unpredictable where the project might go. Like you see these things that people are building in the community and then you're kind of taking a step back and wondering like, oh, I would not have thought of that. But you do see the community grow and you see sort of projects take shape. So if it were kind of up to you and also kind of like what you're seeing, like what might be the future for any widget? Like this whole ecosystem of things that are popping up, like what are some things that are on the horizon or things that you're hoping that will be on the horizon?
Yeah, I think the draw data was such a fun example because at least it demos very well. And the second thing is that it sort of sparked interest in these other frameworks that have support for Jupyter widgets to want to illustrate that they can also like support this visualization. And so one piece that's sort of, I guess, not the best documented in any widget, but there are many different environments and increasingly ones that I'm not even aware of yet that have built in support for Jupyter widgets because they want to be able to support and execute IPy notebooks. And so there are many of the older or sort of these dashboarding libraries have very formal support for Jupyter widgets, but that's a pretty complex mechanism to implement. And so they've built in support because it's sort of widgets are this common denominator and like official part of the Jupyter framework. So supporting widgets has sort of been a priority for some of these platforms that want to be Jupyter compatible.
And include VS Code and like those parties or the...
Yes, exactly. So things that are really built upon like the Jupyter kernel, like want to like add support for widgets because it's something that users have this expectation when they pip install something that it like works. It should just work.
Yeah.
But what's exciting is that like from early on, and this is sort of any widgets like, or as a community, our ability to sort of like look at the ecosystem and try to make like API decisions that I think will like benefit in the long term. So one thing that we've done in the front end, I mentioned that like you write these ECMAScript modules, but we've also tried to like reduce what you as the developer have access to in these, like in that module from the Python side, or these like the ability to like add callbacks and send messages. And the goal there is to like narrow the API surface area in a way that it's actually easier to add support for any widget in environments that aren't even necessarily like Jupyter based. So you sort of have this contract between that bit of Python code that you write and like the JavaScript code that you write, but it doesn't even necessarily have to be like the Jupyter kernel or COM that's making those messages. So one really nice thing that came out of Marimo, like this was a vision that I sort of had for the project, but no one had actually implemented it, was that Marimo is this notebook environment that's not based on Jupyter, but they were able to add support for any widget because like the API is more simple and narrower than like the underlying like original like Jupyter widgets implementation.
Right. And so for the Marimo people, they were looking at these widgets and kind of going like, oh, that's a large surface area to support. But then AnyWidget came along and said, well, you know, the 2080 rule here is we might only need like these special functions to be around and sort of you need to communicate with those. But once that's covered, you're probably good. Like that's also kind of a thing the library offers to like people who are interested in integrating. You require less surface area to be covered in a way.
Right. So we're sort of seeing this thing where now there might be more notebooks or things like AnyWidget start off as this project to like make Jupyter widgets easier. But now, because of its design, it works in more places than actual Jupyter widgets, but also where Jupyter widgets work. And so I think that there's sort of this, what I want, my vision for the project is to really nail down if we need additional APIs, like really have community discussion around like what are those essential features that we need to add. But anything above that, I'm like very much want to have this very stable core that can be reused that really is this idea of this portable ECMAScript module with the Python side.
Yeah, and I can and now that I think of it, there's also projects like Streamlit or Gradio that they also I don't know if Streamlit actually supports Jupyter, but you can imagine that those kinds of projects might also benefit from having a like a widget like thing that you can easily add. And I don't work for the Streamlit company or anything like that, but if I were, I can definitely imagine making it easier to integrate with something is better just in your day to day. Like if it's less effort, the integration is usually a lot tighter. Cool. I guess like a kind of almost more of a final like question or observation, like what areas of maybe science or like applications are out there that ended up using a Jupyter widget that you didn't expect? So like one thing I can't imagine, you're from the biomedical domain. So, you know, there's types of visualizations that are very useful there. And there's also plenty of challenges. But then astronomy comes around and astronomy says, well, we have this other use case actually that we also need. And like, I can imagine that on the horizon, there's a bunch of these science fields that are also going to have very specific support for very specific visualizations for their field. Like, is there something on the horizon there that you're looking forward to as well?
Yeah, I think that it's fun. I've now sort of like automated trying to make this gallery and it's fun to see like things that pop up and try to, you know, like understand what the use cases are. Because I'm familiar with like the libraries that my lab has worked on or like sort of related fields. But yeah, when I saw the, this astronomy widget, like I think that we'll continue to see like domain experts that maybe choose to dip their toes into JavaScript a little bit, bringing the libraries that they're familiar with into the Jupyter environment or into these Python interactive environments. And so, it's just really exciting to me to think about, I guess the potential there for, and also like distributed ownership over like who is responsible for those widgets. So usually with visualizations that you have sort of these like monolithic libraries that have to cover like all aspects of visualization, statistical plots. Like you have sort of Matplotlib like and
Seaborn like, and yeah.
And like, I think what widgets allow are like, you can define like this very narrow piece of functionality that like is useful. And then you can connect to these other types of more like plotting, like statistical plotting libraries. And so what I hope is that like we see a lot more reusable visualization building blocks and less of these sort of like monolithic like visualization applications that like have cool visualizations in them, but they never find their way into like a Jupyter environment. And now like someone can actually maybe use a we have a project that's like this genome browser, and then we have this Jupyter scatter plotting library. And we have examples where we're looking at like embeddings of the genome with like a high glass genome browser, and you're able to brush and pan and zoom both of them at the same time. And they're too, like the scatterplot library has no idea that it's talking to like a genome browser, but like you're able to configure that with widgets. So I think there's really this like aspect where you can remix these visualizations in exciting ways that we also can't anticipate as like library authors.
Yeah. So it's not so much that, it's not so much that people might add a new Lego brick. It's also that people might come up with new ways to click Lego bricks together, kind of a feeling. Because I can definitely imagine that you're the genome researcher going to the Matplotlib, like, hey, could you add my genome plot? Like, I can imagine that being a tough sell. But being able to say, well, just make this the smallest little widget that has your need in it, and from there click it together with all the other stuff. Yeah, that can also be like a very powerful way. I think there's also Voila around the corner for this stuff, right? Like you can, Voila is like a plugin for Jupyter. If you have widgets in a notebook, that you can quickly turn that into a web app. There's also like a thing that people can hook up to this, right?
Yeah. Maybe it's worth emphasizing that like So widgets like originally came around to work in notebooks, but then they've been adopted by a lot of different things that are sort of like dashboarding libraries or ways of creating like standalone web applications. So this ability to connect these Lego bricks, as you said, also means that you can connect them to create like a web app with Shiny for Python or Solera or Panel is another like web framework or Voila, where you can take a notebook and just sort of export it. But all of these frameworks have decided to add widgets, which mean that then any widget just works in all of them as well. And so that's really, you know, like if someone's familiar with Panel and they don't want to learn that much about like Jupyter widgets, like they can sort of connect things together using like Panel's way of doing things, because Panel's figured out how to like map any widget or Jupyter widget concepts into its like reactive paradigm.
So and just like the notebook has its own way of dealing with it, the funny thing about any widget is as long as there's an integration with, let's say, a panel, you can then move on to the panel way of doing things, if that's your prerogative.
Yeah, it has this layered approach of the API, because really I think the contribution of any widget is just standardizing what that front end piece looks like. And that means that then things are pretty standard on the Python side because all these places can execute Python code, but then standardizing the front end means that there's a lot more flexibility to add support for that as well. And so for framework authors, it should hopefully be easier to sort of add these things. And then if you're a panel user, you can just use panel stuff and hopefully, you know, draw data just works there too.
Cool. Then I guess because we are like getting closer to the to time now, is there anything you would like to tell people who haven't played around with any widget yet that you might want to give them as maybe advice or like maybe an inspiration or like anything you would like to maybe say before we wrap up?
Yeah, I'd say any widget's goal is to make creating these types of reusable interactive components a lot easier for Jupyter. And if you're familiar with widgets from before, I think it should come as like maybe very refreshing to try it out. And so I encourage you to try it out. And if you haven't tried widgets before, the motivation behind any widget is to try to simplify a lot of these concepts that can get confused with like the front end. And so the goal is to learn you can learn just enough JavaScript to really build the application or the integration that you want, but hopefully no more than that. And I encourage you to jump on our Discord like Vincent did. And if you have any questions about when you're first learning some of these concepts, I would really recommend coming there and asking questions. There's a lot of exciting examples that are being shared daily. And also I'm pretty active in trying to help people learn some of these front-end evented paradigms, because I think a lot of people that are trying these out for the first time are really coming from a Python background, and I totally get how unfamiliar some of these pieces are. But my hope is that it's very approachable and that the community is very welcoming to trying to help you get started and make an integration and contribution that you'd like to this ecosystem.
Yeah, and definitely what you said, I can second it. Like, it was a very pleasant experience to make this draw data thing happen. And the one thing that definitely stuck with me while designing this draw data widget is there is a sense of just enough JavaScript to get the job done, but I also noticed that there's also just enough widget to get the job done. There are these like weird little moments where having interactivity really helps with teaching. Like sometimes a static chart doesn't cut it, and having something interactive really, really adds to the experience. And once you get a hang of it, it's also like a little motivation to keep on going. Like one thing I might want to do just for fun is have a 2D slider. Like a slider that has like an X axis and a Y axis, and then if you click and drag, you have two inputs instead of one. So like that feeling, right? Like that I could build that in a notebook. That is something really cool about any widget. Like it is a nice little challenge for yourself to reevaluate what UI you want to have for your research or teaching. And
I think as a data scientist, it's like it's another toolkit to have. Like if you are comfortable with jumping in and trying to create these little pieces of your own or even wiring them together, you can maybe tailor a very rich interactive experience for exploring a particular problem. And because any widget is like so committed to like these web standards, my hope is that the concepts that you learn on the front end are transferable as well. So you will like you're learning the JavaScript that the browser understands. And so that also means that like you're not learning some specific framework, like you are likely to be able to contribute to other front end ecosystem things if you would like to as well. So I think it's really expanding your toolkit as a data scientist or as a library developer or as a user. And hopefully then as well, you sort of, experience what's good and bad about the JavaScript ecosystem and also, you know, the superpowers that that gives you in Jupyter.
Yeah. And I guess, okay, final personal note is like, if you're going to spend your day working inside of a Jupyter notebook, you are working inside of a browser. And there's also something about, hey, if you're working in a browser a lot of the time, it's cool to understand it as well. Like, it's nice to sort of unwrap the magic box there and just expose yourself to all the stuff that's possible. If only because it's like a very, it's a rabbit hole. So like you can go deep if you really want, but there's a lot of extra appreciation for Jupyter by going there as well. And so it's something I've kind of noticed. There's a lot of stuff that Jupyter does a lot. Yeah. Trevor, again, like, thanks for making AnyWidget. It's been a blast to see, and I'm really looking forward to what the community does with it. It's been fun to talk to you both on the Discord, and it's super cool you said yes to this interview. I guess, like, as a final thing, if people want to sort of like meet you online, find you, learn about the project, where can I find you?
Yeah, I'm on GitHub as Man's T. Also, check out AnyWidget is under my GitHub handle, Man's T AnyWidget. I'm also on Twitter as Trev. T-R-E-V Mans. And yeah, join the Discord. Hopefully see you there. Thank you for having me, Vincent.
Thanks, you bet. So thanks a lot for listening to Sample Space. This is still definitely kind of a new and somewhat experimental podcast that we're making on behalf of Probable. But we are definitely interested in feedback. Not just feedback on what you might think of the show, we sure love to hear about that. But especially if there are topics and projects that you feel should get some more attention. There are a lot of topics out there that really deserve some more attention, and this is a place where we might be able to give that a little bit of a spotlight. So if you have any advice on that, do let us know and click the links in the show notes. We're definitely eager to get feedback. Thanks for listening.